It's the Pete Callender Show. With more than 20 years as a reporter and radio host in North Carolina, Pete Callender is helping solve the world's problems one podcast at a time. Because he's a giver. And now, here's Pete.
What is going on? Welcome to the show. Thanks so much for listening. I appreciate it, and I appreciate patrons that make this show possible. Folks like Shan, Joseph, Dan, Brian, John, Robbie and Janet, Sarah and Frank, Karen, Manuel, Jeff and Nicole. Thank you very much for all of the support. I could not do the program without you. Actually, Manuel wrote me some time ago and said that he went and got his mattress from Mattress Man in Hendersonville based on their advertisements here on the podcast, and said they provided outstanding service at what I thought was a great price. Delivery and setup was done very professionally, as you mentioned on your podcast. They do ship nationwide. They have free local five-star white glove delivery service. And they have a 120-day comfort guarantee. You can right now get a free upgrade to your mattress. Get a king for the price of a queen, and get a queen for the price of a twin. And remember to take advantage of Mattress Man's refund deal, right? So you can get your tax refund, but you'll have your bed before the refund comes, and then you just pay it off with the tax refund. Also, they've got tons of flexible financing options, like no interest for 2 years. Experience the difference at Mattress Man, mattressmanstores.com, buy local, and sleep better. So we're going to get into this topic a little bit of the vaccine passports, as well as the 60 Minutes story on Florida Governor Ron DeSantis and his vaccine distribution program. But first, joining me now is John Tamney. He's the vice president at FreedomWorks, and he is also the author of a new book. It's available on Amazon and in bookstores. It's called When Politicians Panicked. Welcome to the program, John. How are you?
Great. Thank you so much for having me on.
Certainly. So I almost like started going into the whole topic before I even got you welcome you to the show. So what's the premise of the book? You, obviously, when politicians panicked. So I guess I should start with this with a fundamental question. Like, do you believe that like COVID-19 is real? Is it just the flu? Like, what are your thoughts on that before we get into the reaction from our elected leaders?
I, of course, believe the coronavirus is real and understand what my argument is. My argument is, even if you think it's just real and incredibly lethal, something that would kill tens of millions or millions of Americans, my argument is that is an even greater, what would be the word, testimonial for freedom, for letting people alone. If something's going to kill millions of Americans, what about government forces needed? I don't need a law or someone to hold my hand to cause me to avoid something that might kill me. And so the book is an economic one. It's one that makes a case that the economy was needlessly contracted by panicky politicians who decided to apply force for a virus that they said was spreading like wildfire. Well, if it is, we don't need politicians to lead us around. We will take precautions on our own. Leave us alone so that we can continue to live our lives, so that we can continue to grow. So again, it's an economics book asking why would we destroy the economy to fight a virus?
Is this a position, though, that you get to enjoy as one who is like, I don't know, not an idiot, right? Like, I mean, because there are idiots, right? There are really dumb people out there that would probably not change the way they behaved. So what of that argument? Like, if government didn't do this stuff, it would not have forced people to change their behaviors.
Oh, it's such a good question. And it's something that I address very explicitly in the book. You need those dumb people in order to fight a virus. Yeah, I know it sounds kind of blunt, but the point when a virus is spreading that you don't know everything about, that you're still learning about, you need lots of different reactions. You need free people producing information. Because as you know, some people in response, and you know them, we all know them, quarantined in their house only to never leave. Right. Well, you need those types. You need people who literally exit society, because you need to find out if that's consistent with avoiding the virus, avoiding the spread. We sort of learned from New York as of May of 2020 that maybe it doesn't work, because two-thirds of those hospitalized in New York had been sheltering in place. But again, you need people like that who will just disappear. You also need people like my only occasionally exasperating wife, who every time I would come home, she'd say, did you wash your hands?
Right.
And then we'd be walking down the sidewalk and someone would be walking toward us and she would jump off the sidewalk because she didn't want to get the virus. Well, you know, you need people like that. It frustrated me, but you need people like that. You also need people like me, who the most exciting aspect of their day was going to the grocery store, who were looking for any excuse to get out of the house, who were looking for any reason, just couldn't wait to get to restaurants again, to sit inside restaurants. You need people like me. And then you need young people, or call them stupid people. What do they say that youth is wasted on the young, who just throw caution to the wind, who go to every bar and party they can, make out with every girl and guy they can. You need them too. Because you need to find out by people living their lives and showing different levels of caution what causes the virus to spread. What behavior is most associated with getting really sick? In this case, we just decided to blind everyone in response.
So it's interesting. This is the argument, and you're an economics guy, so I guess this makes sense, because I would have these conversations with people about, you know, free markets versus command control economies. And I often make the case in a sense that, like, how much hubris must you have in order to think that you can make all of these decisions better than millions of people making millions of decisions every single minute of the day all over the planet, right? Like, that sends the most amount of data and signals to the market and to everybody else. And so essentially, you've just taken that idea and applied it to watching a virus.
Oh, absolutely. You clearly understand my book well and how I think very well, because I make that exact point too. In one of the chapters, I talk about the problem of experts. It's not the problem that they're experts. The problem is when we put too much power and decision making in their hands. And it speaks exactly to what you're saying. Anthony Fauci, if he goes to a Washington Nationals game, might be the smartest person in that stadium. It's possible, maybe, maybe not. We don't know. I've heard he's pretty smart.
Is this before the capacity limits or after the capacity limits? I'm sorry. That was my joke. I said that. You don't need to claim credit for that. Anyway, go ahead. I'm sorry to interrupt.
But let's assume 44,000. I think that's capacity at Nationals Park. But you and I know from our discussion that even though he might be the smartest individual in the park, the whole crowd is exponentially smarter than Anthony Fauci is. And I explain in the book that this is free markets at work. It's not that the old Soviet Union didn't have experts. It's not that Cuba doesn't have them. It's not that North Korea doesn't have them. But one person can never have the knowledge that the crowd does, that the market does, this diffuse knowledge, all sorts of different inputs coming in on the way to decisions. And so anytime you hand decision-making power to the very few, you create a crisis. And so I make a case that politicians and the experts are the crisis, not because they're bad people, but because they've deemed a situation crisis-like, and then they self-fulfill it by taking control, taking freedom away from us.
It's also a sort of federalist argument as well, in that if you've got 50 states making different decisions on how to respond, which is actually, Donald Trump took a lot of heat for this. I thought it was actually the right call. Let states try different things. And if one state has found something that works, then everyone else can replicate it. But if you do it at a national level, somebody makes a bad call, it's going to be nationwide. It's going to affect everybody.
No question. And my dispute with Trump was that he didn't make that a bigger point. He said at one point, my power is absolute. Well, it wasn't. And what he should have said, and I talk about this in chapter 17 as sort of a counterfactual, is imagine if he'd said, okay, I acknowledge there's 50 different states making 50 different decisions, but if any state chooses economic desperation, as in lockdowns, as the solution to the virus, they can rest assured they're going to have Donald Trump campaigning in that state up until the election day. And so imagine if Trump does that. For one, he probably gives Republican governors the cover to not lock down, to not do what was inimical to the economy, to health outcomes, to everything, to our psyche, all these things. But he also probably gives some Democratic governors cover, and he also gives world leaders cover. What the U.S. does is has such an influence on the rest of the world, and so he missed out on a political opportunity, but also an economic opportunity. If he had stood firm and said, hey, you guys do what you want, but you're going to have me around embarrassing you if you lock down, he could have had a huge impact and I think saved the U.S. and a lot of the world from a lot of heartache.
So how much of that, though, relies on sort of a 2020 vision, knowing that the lockdowns, and I firmly believe that the lockdowns have caused more harm than benefit. But it is easy for me to say that now. But at the very beginning, when the experts were saying that we don't know what this is, we have no idea, it's brand new, it's really contagious. And, you know, we see pictures of, you know, bodies lying on the street in China. Are we supposed to just like ignore that at the time and say, no, don't lock down. Let's be like Sweden. And like they're like the only one, right, that's not locking down. Is that a politically realistic thing to expect?
It's a very good question. Is it politically realistic? I always argue that's what we expect them. We expect them to be bigger, more expansive, more reasoned thinkers than we are, yet they never are. So,
right.
Okay. So you asked the good question. My argument is that we knew in March that the virus was many things. It wasn't a killer in a major way. And we knew it from China. And so that's the first chapter goes to China. And you look back to March 18th, Fred Smith, founder of FedEx, interviews with Brett Baer on Fox News. And Baer asks him a number of questions. Oh, what do you think about this coronavirus? And so Fred Smith points out that, we've got a big operation in Wuhan, 907 employees. Now, what's important about this is he said we tested them all. Four of them tested positive, two were false positive. But all of our employees are in fine shape. They're not sick. Now, think about that. The virus has been spreading for months. This is the epicenter of it. None of his people are dying. That was Elon Musk's response also. He has a big operation in China. He could see up close that this was many things, not a killer. But let's expand from that. We had market signals before March of 2020 that made it clear it wasn't very lethal. Because U.S. companies, their biggest market, not the U.S., is China. That's true for McDonald's. GM sells more cars in China than it does in North America. Apple, the most valuable company in the world, sells one-fifth of its iPhones in China. Nike, Starbucks, the list goes on and on. If the virus had been indiscriminately killing Chinese people, you would have seen U.S. stock markets crashing in December of 2019, January of 2020, February of 2021. But in truth, those stocks were hitting all-time highs, which was another market signal well ahead of the lockdowns that it was many things. It wasn't a major killer.
So why did we end up with this lockdown concept as a response?
My strong sense is that I think in history, historians will marvel. They'll say, why were people so easily duped? I think this is an accident of history. Yeah. I really do. I can't, because you look at what happened, even if it were lethal, once again, why would you lock people down? Because I don't need a law to stay home. And let's be clear, this is documented in my book. I believe it's chapter 10. But it's well known that the red states, you know, the states that with full of people who don't believe in science,
right,
and that locked it last. Guess what? What did the New York Times document about those states? That their people freely altered their behavior the most, the soonest. Governors were delayed in locking down. And so what did they do? They stopped going out to restaurants as much. They altered their lifestyles because what they'd heard, at least initially, was that this was potentially perilous. And so they made changes on their own. I mean, again, what about the possibility of sickness or death requires you to be led around by the hand. I mean, again, if I can bring my very occasionally exasperating wife back into the picture again, long before the coronavirus spread, she was still always making me wash my hands, making our kids wash their hands. It's just how she is. She's always been a germaphobe. Mm-hmm. In the book, I talk about that Seinfeld episode where Jerry Seinfeld is just notoriously a germ freak. Mm-hmm. Americans have been afraid of this long before the virus was spreading. And so that it was going about didn't call for government to just destroy businesses and jobs indiscriminately. We were already altering our behavior.
More with John in a minute. First, people take CBD products for all sorts of reasons. I take growers hemp CBD oil before I go to bed every night. And when I fall asleep, I sleep deeper than I ever have before. And when I forget to take the CBD, the full spectrum hemp extract, when I forget to take it, which does occur, I can tell. I can tell because I don't sleep as deeply or as long. So go find out what CBD can do for you at growershemp.com. These are North Carolina farmers. They control the whole process from seed all the way to shelf. And that means you get better quality, you get a lower price, and you're helping save North Carolina family farms because they're the ones who created it. It's basically like a co-op model. They were like, hey, all these farmers that we know, why don't we all band together because we're growing this crop? Why don't we band together and control the process rather than, you know, hand it over to some other entity from out of state that, you know, doesn't really appreciate the North Carolina farmer like we might. And so go to the website. You can read their story. You can read all about the business. It's at growershemp.com. And when you check out, use my name, Pete, you'll get 20% off. Growershemp.com. Check out their ad in Our State Magazine. You can find it on the shelves of the Broad River Hemp Company in Shelby, the Medical Pharmacy in Locust, the Durham Co-op as well, and at growershemp.com. As with all CBD products, here's the official disclaimer that GovCo requires. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. The efficacy of these products has not been confirmed by FDA-approved research. These products are not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease, and nothing I've said is meant as a substitute for or alternative to information from your healthcare provider. Please consult your healthcare professional about potential interactions or other possible complications before using any product. GrowersHemp.com. That's the website, GrowersHemp. They've got topicals. They've got the oils, they've got lozenges. So go to the website, check them out. Remember, my name, Pete, at checkout for 20% off. Growershemp.com. It's about the hemp and not the hype. I'm speaking with John Tamney. He is the vice president at FreedomWorks and the director of its Center for Economic Freedom. His new book is called When Politicians Panicked. So how much of this is risk assessment that individuals make? Because I've seen now a couple of surveys Gallup has done for Franklin Templeton. The first one came out, I want to say it was probably back like over the summer, and now they just did an update to it. And I have long believed that this is probably the most important piece of information when trying to understand how our society is reacting. And it's about risk assessment and how the vast majority of Americans have a wild misperception about the risk of catching COVID-19 and dying from it. Am I off base?
No, you're clearly not off base. And it's so fascinating. One of the things I did to protect myself from, because I was against the lockdowns from day one, is I made sure in writing the book that I was getting most, at least half, but probably more of my statistics from the New York Times, because I wanted to check my own stridency that there was a major injustice going on. Now, the interesting thing about the Times is that headlines were invariably very alarmist, but you read deeply into the stories, and invariably they reported the things that you know about, but that very few do. And one of the things that David Leonhardt, a very left-leaning columnist there, has consistently reported is that the mere hospitalization rate for those who catch it is somewhere below 1%. The Times was consistently reporting that the number of people who would die per 1,000 infections or cases was about 6. They kept reporting that. They kept reporting consistently that of the American deaths from the coronavirus or with it, for the longest time, it was over 40% of those deaths were related to very sick people in nursing homes. That number is now down to 30%. But is that any surprise? Why? Obviously, people adjusted the behavior of seniors in response to what was happening. And so the number declined. The Times kept reporting that. this stuff, yet it's not getting out because the headlines, the alarmist headlines were, oh my gosh, hospitals are overrun with people, everyone's dying, there's blood in the streets. That's the impression you got on the front page. But if you read deeply into the stories, you got the actual story.
So how large of a role did and does media play? And full disclosure, I've got an opinion about this, but I'd like to hear yours. Well, how big of a role was the media in all of this? Did the media prompt government to do what it did, or did government tell media and media just dutifully report it?
It's such a good question. I am on the outside in my opinion on this, in that I, in the book, argued that the media's role was overstated. And I based that on the idea, on the basic truth that Facebook is so popular, that Twitter is so popular, that all this social media. And my point there is, if you went to my Facebook page, even though I was reading the New York Times all the time and I was getting my statistics, I was getting from the Wall Street Journal and credible media and all this, everything that I got in my feed was pointing out how baseless all the alarmism was. Similarly on Twitter. Compare that to 20, 30, 40 years ago. You know, you only had a few media options. There were the powerful newspapers. There were the three networks. There was PBS. And so I believe that we got a much more balanced assessment of the virus in 2021 or 2020 than we would have gotten in 1980. But of course, I make the argument in the book that in 2000 or 1980, there's no way there could have ever been lockdowns because too many people had jobs that were destinations. And so ultimately, I blame the lockdowns on the sad truth that we could lock down, that we're such a rich country today that we can occasionally take breaks from reality.
Well, and this is, I've seen it referred to as lockdown privilege, and keying
great
off,
point.
Yeah, and keying off of that term privilege that now like just infects everything, but it is really a good term for it in that there are people, and look, I put myself in this category. I've been able to do this show from my house every single day for the last year, and my wife goes out. She didn't have to. She could have worked from home somewhat, but she's a paralegal, and she could have gone back to the office. And she was, quote unquote, essential personnel. But there's this privilege that exists where people who are, screaming, everybody stay home or else you want people to die, yet they're relying on people to deliver them all of their essentials for daily living. It's such a disconnect.
Oh, one of the chapters in the book is hashtag rich man's coronavirus. It was my argument from the beginning. So many of the Americans who are in power to make decisions, for them, this was just, a vacation from rush hour and everything. They could continue doing their jobs. And so I make the point that in the year 2000, lockdowns, are you kidding? See, in the year 2000, there was no grocery delivery. Remember how a web van died very quickly?
Yeah.
So there was no grocery delivery. There was no Grubhub and Postmates and Uber Eats. You know, those subhumans that would drop off food to rich Americans. And rich Americans during all this would put in the comments box, drop it at the door with exclamation points, as in, you can't touch us, you subhumans delivering our food.
Right.
Do not touch us, but drop our food off.
Yeah.
And there was no... If you wanted a video, it was Blockbuster night, remember? Because, see, Netflix was still trying to be purchased by Blockbuster, and there were Netflix didn't have all these shows to stream because internet wasn't fast enough, which means there was no, Peloton at home, and there was no Facebook and all this. But you see, Mark Zuckerberg was in high school, so all these well-to-do Americans who could afford to stay at home and work couldn't, signal all their virtue to all their friends while they're at home talking about all the different ways they've adjusted to life in COVID world and everything. There's no way there could have been lockdowns back then. So I'm always for growth. I make a growth argument in the book, but there one downside is it enables a lot of people to be intensely stupid.
Yes. Well, and I also wonder not just the stupidity component, but the mental health component as well. I'm not sure if this uncovered a lot of mental health issues in our society, or if it created it, or maybe it exacerbated it. Maybe it's all of the above. I see people acting in very irrational ways when it comes to this risk assessment and their response. People, like in the classic example now, is like the person driving their car alone wearing a mask. Like, even if you believe the masks work, and I'm not here to debate the efficacy of them, but if you believe they work and you're in your car alone, you don't need to be wearing it in the car alone. But people have gone nuts on some of this stuff.
Yeah, they have. And again, it's hard to know what it's meant for everyone. In my case, I'm married and the father of two very young kids. And so I always make the point to others that at this stage in your life, you're already locked down. I was still infuriated by it. I still couldn't wait to get out of the house. But I think, and I imagine what it's been like for young people.
Yeah.
And then I throw in, in one of the chapters, I tell a story about someone around where we live. My wife is on a listserv in our neighborhood in Montgomery County, Maryland. I'm not allowed on it because she says I would offend everyone. But the point is they shut down. They announced last August that public schools in Montgomery County will not be opening. They will be virtual. And so some innocent mother gets on among all these jackals saying, why isn't everyone staying at home and wearing masks everywhere? And she says, well, you know, one thing to think about it, she's talking about her child. Mm. Her child was never popular. Mm. Her child was a bit autistic. The child had finally gotten into the high school band and was making friends. And school was no more. He had finally found a place for himself.
Yeah.
And they robbed it from him. And I hear about these. I can't talk about this subject without just raising my voice. It makes me so mad because these stories, you have to multiply them. You think about college kids. These are the best years of their lives. And I've always thought that college education is somewhat overrated. But the chance to get to know people and make new friends and everything that's good about college is being taken from kids. It's just the sickness of politicians and the way they've responded to this. It's hard to think about and hard to talk about without just becoming infuriated.
There's a friend of ours whose father was in a nursing home and had developed Alzheimer's dementia and could not understand. He kept asking them what he had done wrong. It's just heartbreaking. And again, like you said, multiply that thousands and thousands and thousands of times. And there's never an accounting when people say, like our governor, I'm in North Carolina and we're still under mask mandate. Our governor is doing this whole dimmer switch approach. And every, 2 weeks he comes out and lets us know a little bit more freedoms we're allowed to have back. And there's this constant drumbeat that the mask mandate and the lockdowns, all of his actions have saved lives. And I always ask on the Twitter, feeds for the North Carolina political groups and such. Well, what about the other side of that ledger, right? Are there costs associated with all of this? When do we get an accounting of that? Do you take a stab at any of that in the book about what the costs have been for some of these policies?
Oh, yeah. Without you can't write a book about this, about the economics of it, without talking about that all the time. There's this desire among people to produce policy, among politicians to do things. But as you and I know, a classical accounting of everything asks for the unseen. What are the second, third, and fourth order effects of politicians doing what they do, of imposing all this? And it's essential to ask, and not just in the United States. Can we point out what it means for the rest of the world when the United States takes a break from reality? And so in the book, I talk about soaring rates of poverty around the world. See, Americans remit enormous sums of money to very poor parts of the world from their production here. But when you're destroying tens of millions of jobs, a lot less remittances take place. So much of what Americans do as a consequence of their work employs people around the world. Suddenly they're not. And so you have the World Food Program. This was in the New York Times. Again, you could get all this information from the Times if you look for it. 285 million people rushing towards starvation around the world so that a bunch of rich white nail biters can feel better about some virus. Hundreds of millions headed toward poverty around the world, not to mention all the people around the world who were on the way to emerging from jobs that had been in their families for centuries. That's what poor countries do. Jobs are basically passed down among generations. Their kids had a way out. Suddenly they were out of school altogether. They had lost their chances to basically move up in society because, again, the developed world decided that it was afraid of a virus and wanted to run and hide from it.
How much of a response how much of this response was due to anti-Trumpism? and people's loathing of Donald Trump, and they needed a break because, like you said, they took a time out because they were so tired of Donald Trump.
It's interesting. I would be lying if I denied that. What if Obama is still president? Would the media have reacted in the way they did? I imagine no. But again, as you know, I'm not tying this all to media.
Right.
And to make it all about Trump, what explains the rest of the world committing suicide in the way it did? And what would explain, for instance, a Democratic governor in Nevada shutting down casinos and destroying that economy there and just destroying jobs indiscriminately? Would they do that just to get at Trump? I mean, I don't think so. Again, my view remains that this was an accident of history, and it was also driven by Americans are so rich that they've gotten to the point where they can kind of, you know, the latest step in our prosperity, which, again, there's everything cuts both ways, is that we can kind of shut things down for a bit, put things in deep freeze and then come back to it later. Who cares what happens to the poor people? Who cares what happens to those with the least? We can't be bothered with them because we're too busy, ordering our Uber Eats and watching Netflix. And so, again, I am so in love with rich people and economic growth, and I make this point in the book. What the big enemy in all this to me is the American middle class. I hate to say it, is that they in many ways enabled this to happen. For them, it was a break. It was a break from having from rush hour and everything. I refuse to blame rich people. I think it's just the typical American.
Well, and the reason I was asking about Trump was only because you had mentioned that people wanted a break. And I'm thinking not necessarily that it's like to get at Trump, but it's because of the last 4 years, people have been whipped into such a frenzy, you know, polarized pro and con. And it's just like, you know what? Just want to unplug. I want to go home. I want to crawl into bed, just cover my cover up in blankets and just ignore everything for as long as possible. And this was an excuse to do so. I don't know. It just comes to mind. Listening to what you talk about this accident of history proposal.
Yeah, no, it's hard to ignore. But again, if it were that, I would. It strikes me that other countries would have said, oh, wait, the U.S. is locking down. Well, we're not going to be that ridiculous. So.
Right. John Tamney, a vice president at FreedomWorks and the director of its Center for Economic Freedom. The name of the book is called When Politicians Panicked. It is available at Amazon and at local bookstores as well. John, thanks so much for your time today. I certainly appreciate you spending it with me.
Hey, Peter, thank you so much for having me on. What a great podcast and interview. I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you. That's very kind. Here's something you're going to thank me for, this recommendation I'm about to give you, okay? General Equipment Rental. In Weaverville. If you've got a project around the house or on a job site and you don't have the right tool for it, chances are you're going to mess up that project. It's going to cost you more money, more frustration, take you longer to finish it, right? Get on over to General Equipment Rental. They have the tools that you need for whatever the job is you're looking to get done. And you just use their tool. They're going to show you how to use it. You use their tool and then you bring it back. Job done quickly. Without damage, no collateral damage because you used the wrong tool. How about this? They are also your official licensed Husqvarna and Honda outdoor power equipment sales and service provider. What does this mean? It means they're experts on these tools, on power equipment. And that also means they know of the deals. Like through the end of this month, you can get the Husqvarna stand-on mower, the V548 or V554, with a $1,000 instant rebate. Then there's another deal that they know about that you can sort of layer on top of that. You can stack the deals. And that other one is 25% off the MSRP when you buy a 9-point fleet item. So you add these two deals together, you've got a new Husqvarna stand-on mower for $3,500 off the price. So go to General Equipment Rental, go to their website, General Rents, and you'll see the deals I'm talking about, as well as all the other inventory. So if you've got, you know, spring maintenance that's getting underway at the house or at the estate or at the farm, you need to go to General Equipment Rental. They've got all the tools that you need. GeneralRents.com, General Equipment Rental in Weaverville. They're at the intersection of Merriman Avenue and Reams Creek Road. They're family-owned and operated. They have been for three generations. And I ask you to support businesses that support me and this show. So I appreciate that. General Equipment Rental, generalrents.com. Think outside your toolbox. All right, so John Sanders from the John Locke Foundation, frequent guest here on the program, he writes, in early March, President Joe Biden sharply criticized the governors of Texas and Mississippi for lifting the mask mandates, right, and relaxing a lot of the COVID restrictions, the lockdowns and such. Remember, he accused them of Neanderthal thinking and said they were making a big mistake. You know, people are going to die from this. Fast forward to the end of the month, and COVID cases continuing to decline in both Texas and Mississippi. But this is happening all over the place. Now, there is a perception among a lot of GovCo officials, but also predominantly people on the left, that the perception is that the mask of the all-wise central planner can dictate even the progress of a virus. And that when governors start relaxing these restrictions while others do not, right, it shows that some of these orders that have been implemented really haven't been effective. It's not that Texas and Mississippi's results are unusual. Other states with mask mandates, Sanders writes, are also seeing case declines. It's consistent with natural seasonality as well as expanding natural immunity along with vaccine-induced immunity. What it's showing is that case declines are consistent with those things, the natural progress of the virus, not with mask mandates. For Biden and the long list of U.S. governors with their own house blends of distinctions among activities the virus supposedly does and doesn't allow, what they need, among other things, is an understanding of just how limited their plans and powers really are in the face of a natural force. Arbitrary and capricious COVID orders infest from California and Michigan to New York and Connecticut. Roy Cooper in North Carolina has even distinguished between party buses that are safe and tour buses, which are banned, private bars, not safe, and bars, totally safe. Those are all okay. So the private bar is unsafe. Bars and restaurants and taverns and breweries, those are all okay. So this is in a piece at AIER.org. Biden and the lockdown governors need Canute thinking. Canute was a king. He explains this story of the king who was told that he was so powerful, you know, he could stop the ocean from coming in. And so he sat on the beach. And then when he started to get wet from the tide coming in, he realized he wasn't all powerful. The lesson, he says, is that the forces of nature obey their creator, not a man who is elevated to rule over other men, but who is still a man. The governed, who believe otherwise, are simpletons, while the ruler who acts on that belief is destined to be frustrated, a tyrant exposed as a fraud. If we forsake self-reliance, he says, and our own wisdom and experiences, but choose instead to look to government out of fear to save us from a natural force, few leaders will have the humility to admit that such a thing is beyond the reach of the state, keeping the mask of the all-wise central planner, saving us by forcing certain actions on us for our own good, is only possible if every leader does it. When some stop and others never started, it then becomes evident that there's no link between state mask mandates and natural outcomes. The phoniness gets revealed. The tide turns. No wonder the central planners are angry and scared. Again, I have these links, by the way, all at the Pete page, the Patreon account, thepetecallinershow.com, has a link there at the top. Meanwhile, in New York, they are rolling out a vaccine passport called the Excelsior Pass. If you want to attend any large public events, including wedding receptions, you won't be able to get one of these unless you have proof that you've been vaccinated or that you can get a temporary one if you produce a fresh negative COVID test. And without the passport, you'll be restricted from most non-essential public activities. Jazz Shaw, quoting the San Diego Union-Tribune at his post about this topic at hotair.com, says the Biden administration and private companies are working to develop a standard way of handling credentials, often referred to as vaccine passports, that would allow Americans to prove they have been vaccinated against the new coronavirus, as businesses try to reopen. The effort has gained, I never know how to pronounce that, novel. It just doesn't sound right. Anyway, the effort has gained momentum And President Joe Biden's pledge that the nation will start to regain normalcy this summer, and with a growing number of companies from cruise lines to sports teams saying that they're going to require proof of vaccination before opening their doors again. The administration's initiative has been driven largely by arms of the Department of Health and Human Services, including an office devoted to health information technology. So Jazz Shaw says that the Biden administration seems to be aware that they won't be able to get away with an executive mandate saying everybody has to be vaccinated, but they can create a system where anyone who either can't or won't sign up for the jab will be effectively on lockdown for all but the most essential activities from here on out. This is simply a case of blackmail. He's exactly right. Jazz Shaw's exactly right. The reward for compliance being, you know, your God-given freedom of movement and public interaction. They are constructing essentially a two-tier society comprised of people without immunity passports and those with the passports. And the most frightening part of all this is the reality that the government may be considering making this a permanent condition. The new rules taking effect in New York do not include any sort of a sunset provision. That's concerning. Lev Fatcher at statnews.com, in a piece called Businesses, Health Experts Join the Ranks of Vaccine Passport Opponents, writes that the concept represents a slippery slope, according to Georges Benjamin, the executive director of the American Public Health Association. I mean, I'm just, his name is Georges. It's like plural, Georges. Anyway, he's afraid this could politicize the vaccine rollout, make health inequities worse, and even lull vaccinated people into a false sense of security, letting them go out more often. They get vaccinated. Oh, I got my passport. I can do whatever I want. And they're like, well, that might not be the best way to go here. And people think that once they get vaccinated, that they won't be able to get sick again, which, yes, that's kind of the whole point. It is a terrible sales pitch to tell people we got to get everybody vaccinated. Oh, but when you do, your life isn't really going to change. It's just a terrible sales pitch. People need to understand that the juice is worth the squeeze on this, like going to Old Grouch's Military Surplus. It's totally worth it. Downtown Clyde on Main Street, Old Grouch's Military Surplus has been there for 30 years. His dad opened it up, and now Tim is running the store. He's got tons of supplies, real U.S. military surplus. Come for the first aid kits, stay for the ammo cans and gun accessories, okay? And also ask about the anti-aircraft gun that is right across the street from the shop. Shops open Monday through Saturday. Old Grouch's Military Surplus. OldGrouch.com is the website. OldGrouch.com. And of course, tell him that you heard it here on the show. See, so it's not just right-wing Republican nut jobs who are against the idea of vaccine passports. I made a point of this over the weekend when I started seeing some of the reporting on this, which is analogy of the sheep, the sheepdogs, and the wolves. And it's about society and law and order and, you know, the warrior heart and that kind of thing. But at its basic level, it's an analogy of people. And the vast majority of people are sheep. And that's not a pejorative. It's not an insult. It's just saying most people, they don't hurt anybody. They're productive members of society. They just go about their daily lives and they go along with people. And they're what you want a society to be mostly comprised of. Then you have the sheepdogs, who would never hurt the sheep, but they do have some of the wolfy kind of tendencies. Because then you have the wolves, who are, you know, the bad dudes. They're going to try to kill all the sheep. And so the sheepdogs are there to protect the sheep, but the sheep kind of resent them, and they're kind of scared of the sheepdogs because the sheepdogs look like wolves, kind of. But they also behave kind of weird, right? This is the connection, is that the sheepdogs are always running around the perimeter of the farm, right? Barking at all of the noises in the night, right? And you're like, oh my gosh, stop it. There's nothing there, right? But here's the thing. Sometimes there is something there. I really encourage people to listen to the sheepdogs on this topic. Please listen to the sheepdogs. North Carolina Democratic Governor Roy Cooper says his administration is having discussions about creating vaccine passports. The passports could allow businesses to determine who's admitted and who isn't for events like concerts or perhaps even indoor dining. This is the story by Steve Harrison at WFAE, the NPR affiliate in Charlotte. Cooper said last week he's looking into it. Quote, we want to be able to help people to be able to show others that they have gotten the vaccine, because a lot of people are going to want that. He was doing a tour of a vaccination site in Gastonia. Quote, so we are figuring that out now, and we are having discussions about the best way to do that. He went on to say, quote, we want to make sure it's equitable. It would be great to have an app where you could show, but at the same time, we know we need paper because a lot of people don't have phones. We have to make sure this is equitable in the way to do it and respect everyone's privacy. I recommended just some sort of a, you know, some sort of a paper ornament or something that we could maybe, you know, pin onto people's shirts or coats, maybe a star or something to identify us all. Vaccination passports have become the latest flashpoint between Democrats and Republicans. In Florida, GOP Governor Ron DeSantis has said he wants to prohibit businesses from using them. So, too, has the South Dakota Governor Kristi Noem. And I like how this is framed as, you know, Republicans are against it and Democrats are for it. Well, that's not always the case. I just gave you, you know, some health experts that are opposed to it. And it's not necessarily a partisan item. It is a question of freedom versus security. And maybe that's why you're trying to put heuristics of D's and R's on this stuff. But maybe that speaks to a larger mentality, a philosophical outlook, if you will, that one party, people who gravitate towards one party, have a particular appreciation or mindset for a philosophy. In this case, it is freedom versus security, that I'm willing to take the risk of a virus that has a 99.95% survival rate for anybody under the age of 70. I'm willing to take a risk there, you know? I'm okay with that. I don't need you restricting all of my movements and economic activity for a virus with that kind of case fatality rate. All right? Now, Ron DeSantis, of course, poses some sort of a threat to a lot of people on the left. It's the only thing I can figure out for the amount of coverage that he gets. That's just it's activism. And this is the latest example. It's 60 Minutes. They did a story this weekend, and it's a story by Sharon Alfonsi. She says, this past week, President Biden said 90% of U.S. adults will be eligible for the COVID vaccine by April 19th and will be able to get their shots within 5 miles of their home. That will be welcome news to many in Florida. For 3 months, we've been reporting around Palm Beach County, the third largest in the state. It's home to old money millionaires, but also some of the poorest day laborers and farm workers in America. During those months, we watched Florida's vaccine rollout deteriorate into a virtual free-for-all and watched as some wealthy and well-connected residents cut the line, leaving other Floridians without a fair shot. Without a fair shot. This is the town of Palm Beach. Privacy hedges hide beachfront mansions and a healthy share of billionaires. More than 80% of the town's seniors have been vaccinated. Ron DeSantis, this is me now, Ron DeSantis made a call, right, as governor. He said, we're going to focus on the elderly population, right? Shouldn't they be the top priority? I've been saying this for a year. If they're the ones who have the highest risk of death from COVID-19, it seems like you should be protecting them the most. They then interview Keith James. He's the mayor of West Palm Beach, and I assume he's completely apolitical, nonpartisan, because he's never identified by his party affiliation. It's not on the beach at all, but the intercoastal waterway. The median income in West Palm Beach is about $28,000 a year compared to $70,000 in the town of Palm Beach. James told us after he and other mayors complained about the town of Palm Beach getting 1,000 doses that the county health director took the blame, calling it a miscommunication. And he says, oh, the county health director's, you know, fallen on the sword and said it was her bad, her organization's mistake. They made a mistake. Okay, but that... So they don't ever interview that person, find out what the mistake was, why 1,000 doses went to one community versus another. They don't give any other examples in this story. But then a few weeks later, they go on to say Governor Ron DeSantis, breaking from CDC guidelines, announced that he would not vaccinate teachers and essential workers next, but instead would put seniors first, making anybody over the age of 65 eligible for the vaccine, the first in the country to do that. DeSantis said seniors were at the highest risk. Well, it's not just DeSantis that says that. It's the science and data and facts. The science and data and facts. Oh, my. Science and data. See, they're all about the science and the data when it lets them do what they want to do, right? If it advances their agenda, then it's all about the science and the data. But when DeSantis is like, hey, this is killing a whole bunch of old people, why don't we focus on that population? Now all of a sudden it's, well, DeSantis says this. Florida's 4.5 million seniors started competing against each other for the vaccine. No. Yes. It's happening all over the country. This is what happens when you have a limited supply with outsized demand, right? More demand than supply means you're going to have this. It's going to drive up costs or it's going to restrict access. This is how it happens. I'm always amazed when people on the left are confronted by like the only options that are available in our world, right? And I'm sorry that it has to be one or the other, but it is. Whether you restrict something that is limited supply but high demand, you're either going to restrict it by access or you're going to restrict it by cost. Those are your options, folks. In the rush, public health department phone lines failed, computer sites crashed. I mean, this is okay. So, shocker of shockers, a state government was not prepared for the rollout of a program during a pandemic. North Carolina saw it with the unemployment system, right? All of these state governments are doing the best they can with the resources they have and the limited knowledge they have and the personnel they have, right? I recognize this. I beat up the governor on the stuff that I think he can actually change and the decisions that I think he's making that are not based on the data and science. In West Palm Beach, Mayor James said he was still trying to secure vaccines for his town's firefighters when he learned that at a nursing home in town, some board members and their wealthy pals got vaccinated, even though those doses were only supposed to be given to elderly residents and staff. Okay, I disagree with that. I disagree with that. Those people should not have gotten ahead of the line. But why was that? Is that Ron DeSantis's fault? Hollywood moguls, New York socialites, tourists from overseas, they were all swooping into Florida, getting vaccinated, posting on social media and sparking outrage. This is why you saw these stories in North Carolina as well about people coming from across state lines, right? But here's the thing. It's a federal asset. And as a federal asset, they couldn't restrict it. And until just recently where the Fed said you can try to limit it now. But there are things that you could try to do. But again, are you practicing battlefield medicine? Are we trying to get as many shots in as many arms as possible, or are we not? Right? And like, this is, everyone's trying to figure this out, and mistakes are going to be made. People are going to take advantage. Guess what? I bet not everybody who said they were a frontline essential worker was actually a frontline essential worker. I bet there were some people that lied to get a vaccine, but we don't hear those stories so much, right? People are going to behave like this in any kind of a panic situation, which is what we have, which is what you want to avoid, by the way, when you're buying or selling a home, which is why you need Rowena Patton. You know, you just take the panic out of this, okay? You need, you know, clear eyes, level head, someone who has done this so many times. They know the pitfalls and the things to avoid. Call Rowena Patton and her All-Star Powerhouse team. 333-4483. The website is mountainhomehunt.com. She outsells 99% of the realtors in North Carolina, and she's the only agent that we called when Christy and I, we started to look to buy our house. So call her today, 333-4483, mountainhomehunt.com, and then start packing. So the 60 Minutes story then goes on to attack the decision that DeSantis made to push the vaccination programs through Publix. Now, they were already doing it in CVS's and Walgreens and the like, but Publix stepped up and they were like, look, you know, we got grocery stores all over the place. They did a trial run and they did well. And so then they expanded the program. And DeSantis went over all of this and then CBS edited out his explanation and they just used the clip of the reporter at a press conference. She crashed a press conference and she attacks DeSantis and accuses him of engaging in pay to play because Publix donated money to DeSantis's reelection PAC. The director of Florida's Division of Emergency Management, a former three-term Democratic state legislator, Jared Moskowitz, said that Publix was recommended by government agencies as the other pharmacies were not ready to start, period, full stop. No one from the governor's office ever suggested Publix get this contract. It's absolute malarkey. All right, that's a wrap for the episode. Please remember, subscribe to the podcast and give it a positive review if you don't mind. Consider becoming a patron of the program. Get cool stuff and exclusive content. Links are all at thepetecallinershow.com. Thanks so much for the support. Talk with you later. Don't break anything while I'm gone.